I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
Picture this. You're halfway through a DIY Carfix, tools scattered everywhere, and boom, you realize you're missing a part. It's okay, because you know whatever it is, it's on eBay. They've got everything. Brakes, headlights, cold air intakes, whatever you need. And it's guaranteed to fit, which means no more crossing your fingers and hoping you ordered the right thing. All the parts you need, at prices you'll love. Guaranteed to fit, every time. eBay. Things, people, love.
There are some racing drivers, champions in other categories, who I'd have loved to have seen in Formula One. Dario Franchitti is one of them. A four-time IndyCar Series champion and a three-time winner of the Indy 500, he's a certified racing legend. He came close to F1, so why didn't it happen?
I wanted to win an F1, and by that point I was driving race-winning equipment in IndyCar, and I was maybe not prepared to be as patient or risk getting in some car that was not a front-running car straight away. I wasn't prepared to go all in for my F1 dream. I wasn't prepared to risk what I had in America.
Here on F1 Beyond the Grid, with me, Tom Clarkson, Dario talks about the three big chances he had in F1 and why he didn't take them. It's a fascinating insight into how his career could have played out very differently. Dario, it is great to see you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, we finally got together.
We have finally got together in this amazing office that you have in the UK. Now, I knew you love motorsport, but I had no idea that you had so much memorabilia around here.
This is the tip of the iceberg. It's a bit of a problem.
Dario, just to paint a picture, how many helmets have we got sitting above us?
I don't know, 30?
30 from, you know, everyone from, well, you name it, Jenson Button and Mario Andretti, Emerson Fittipaldi, all the way through to some IndyCar stars. And then on the far wall, I'm going to keep going, there's books. You've got a wonderful picture of painting of Greg Moore, your former buddy in IndyCar. It's sensational. That's to say nothing of the F40 that's the other side of that wall.
Yeah, that was a good use of prize money, buying that car back in the late 90s. No, I'd love racing. You know that. I love it. It's my passion. Cars are my passion. Racing's my passion. I'm an absolute anorak for it. And I love everything about cars, about our sport, whether that's sports cars, IndyCar, NASCAR, F1, rallying, you name it. I love it.
Well, the evidence is all around me. And I've read that you've got a lot of Jimmy Clark stuff as well. Is that right?
I do. There's a building up in Scotland that's known as the I Love Me building because it's full of old cars and things like my pace cars from Indy, all my old memorabilia. And there's a Jim Clark room in there, which is full of
So it's like there are two Jim Clark museums in Scotland. There's the one at Dunn's and then there's the one at Dario's place.
Yeah, the one in Dunn's is incredible. It's just been done up, I say just, 4 or 5 years ago, and it's stunning. It's such a great tribute to Jim. And, you know, this is the 60th anniversary of his 1965 season with the Indy 500 win and the Formula One World Championship. So there's going to be a lot of celebrating of Jim.
Dario, what is it about Jimmy Clark? We'll come on to you in a minute, but just what was it about Jimmy that you admired so much, makes you want to have so much of his memorabilia?
It started with Jackie when I was driving for Paul Stewart Racing. In 93, Jackie, there was a dinner going to happen in Edinburgh to commemorate 25 years of Jim's passing. And Jackie said, you should really come to this. I think it'll be special. I think I sat next to Eric Dimmock and I sat and talked to a bunch of Jim's old competitors, friends, you name it. And I just thought, who is this guy? And I think it was because of the way he did it. I mean, he's obviously so good from Scotland. Like, you know, and Jackie is also my hero. I've got as much Jackie memorabilia, I think, as maybe Jim. But the fascination was there because with Jackie, I've always had the privilege and ability to pick up the phone. With Jim, Jim died 5 years before I was born. And so there was that disconnect. And I've just always been fascinated by him. You know, it goes back to that, you know, being from Scotland and how lucky were we as a, Jackie would say, as such a wee nation to have these great drivers go before us. And they were ultimately, you know, with them, with David Leslie, after that, they were the light that we followed, we being David, Alan and myself, and then a lot of drivers after that. Mm.
Alan McNish. I mean, have you ever studied Jimmy? As in, have you ever tried to work out what made him so good?
I think he had this balance, whatever you call it. He had that thing, didn't he? I guess the best example of that today is Max Verstappen. You know, that ability to feel the car better than others. Just he's got that sort of level of fidelity that nobody else has. Obviously, a much different sport back then with the dangers. All the greats have had that.
Did you ever form a relationship with an engineer as close as Jimmy and Chapman were?
I was fortunate to, you know, throughout my formative years. And I could list all the engineers I worked with, whether it was the guys at Paul Stewart Racing, maybe Gerhard Unger at Mercedes, Alan McDonald. I won my first Indy 500 with Alan. But then Chris Simmons, who was actually a competitor of mine at Ganassi. Chris was, when I say competitor, he was racing Indy Lights when I started IndyCar. And he thought he was going to get the drive at Team Green because he was racing their Indy Lights car and I came in and took it. So it's a little awkward for the first 5 minutes of our relationship, shall we say, as driver and engineer. But my relationship with Chris goes on to this day because I, you know, working with Chip still. And when you have a level of respect in the person, but also in the other person's abilities, and that, I think that went both ways, but also a will to win enough to challenge each other every single day. I think that's when those special relationships form. I've always said this, I was lucky with the teams I drove for, with engineers, with the teammates I had.
You achieved a huge amount of success in America, which we'll come on to in a minute. Can we start by talking about F1 now? How close did you get to making it happen?
When you say it, there was probably three big chances. The McLaren testing deal, the Jaguar deal, and then a chance with BAR after that. Those were probably, I think, the three main chances of getting into F1.
Dario, let's break it down then. You talk about the McLaren chance, okay? So you test for them. I think it's December 1995. You're in Jerez. Tell us more.
I was actually giggling the other day. Good old laugh to myself because I was in Mayfair in London and I passed the Chesterfield Hotel, where we used to have the after party of the Autosport Awards. And I remember the test was the day after the Autosport Awards.
Oh, dangerous.
Dangerous. So normally I would have been the person at the after party, but I was, there had none of that going on that year. And we were sitting in a car waiting to go to the airport to fly to Jerez, and all the usual suspects were in the after party. But anyway, what had happened, won the McLaren Autosport, as it was then, Young Driver of the Year in 92. And one of the prizes, the big prize really, was a test in the McLaren F1 car. And that would consist of some laps at Silverstone or whatever normally. But because Mercedes and McLaren were together and I was a Mercedes junior driver, it was decided I would go to Jerez and get a half day in the car. So myself, my teammate in DTM, Bernd Schneider, went headed out there. And I think later in the week, I think Jamie Davis and I think Ralph Furman were to drive the car as well, who guys that had won the Young Driver Award after. So that was the prize for that. And it was wonderful. It's not a car that maybe is fondly remembered. I think it was MP410, would that
be
right? It was
the MP410 with the mid-wing, and it was the one that Mansell couldn't fit in earlier in the year. And I think Hakkinen managed to get a podium out of it at one point, but it was certainly not one of McLaren's finest.
No, but I remember getting in the car, and it was from the headrest forward where I sat, it looked like the car that Senna had driven. You know, that slightly high nose, the shape of the steering wheel, still the same steering wheel shape that, that Senna had, had used. It was the Marlboro colour still. And I loved it. There was definitely a contrasting bunch of emotions going on. Schneider and myself were absolutely buzzing having driven this car. And David Coulthard was there. And it was his first test for McLaren, having left Williams with the that wonderful car. And David was shell-shocked, quite frankly, how bad he felt this car was. And we were absolutely on cloud nine. And I got to work with Alain Prost that day and the team at McLaren, Indy Lal, and the test team. And it was one of those moments in life. Yeah, it went well and I loved everything about it.
You'd been racing DTM that year. How long did it take you to sort of get up to speed with everything, F1?
Well, if you think, we didn't have simulators at the time. There was no, okay, let's go to the sim at McLaren and get up to speed. And I hadn't, it was about a year since I'd driven a single-seater that had been the F3 car. The DTM car was a very different beast. But it seemed to, you know, get up to speed pretty quickly. I'd managed to do some training on my neck. It always comes as a surprise, though, the G-forces in an F1 car. Yeah, at that time, I think no power steering either. So it was physically quite demanding, but I got up to speed pretty quickly.
I mean, so this is December 95, and the previous month, Mika Häkkinen had had his awful accident in Adelaide. He was in recuperation and I think doing well, but was there ever a conversation with you that if Mika's not ready for Melbourne start of 1996, that could you sit in until he was ready, race the car?
I'd forgotten about that, Tom. I'd forgotten that was that horrible accident. No, I don't think there was, because Jan Magnussen, who had been teammates with in F3 when he'd absolutely destroyed me, just absolutely destroyed me. We'd been teammates then, and then we went to DTM together as teammates, and I got my own back. But he was the McLaren test driver, and it was very much, I think if anything was going to happen, it was probably Jan that was going to jump in the car.
All right, so the test goes well. Was there any contact with Ron Dennis at the time? Obviously Norbert Haug you knew very well from Mercedes, but any message from Ron?
Yeah, I got a letter from Ron. As I said, I keep everything. I've got it up in the I Love Me building, and it said something like, you know, great job at the test. Unfortunately, we're not going to be using you as a test driver because we've got Jan, blah, blah, blah. But great job, and who knows what the future brings. I think it was something like, I'm paraphrasing, I haven't read it in quite a few years, but that was the sort of the contact at that point.
Well, that's a beautiful segue into what happened a couple of years later. You are by now carving a path in North America, in Champ Car, doing really well with Mercedes backing, but you get the call.
DTM ITC, as it had become, had basically priced itself into oblivion at the end of mid-end of 96, and I'd gone to the end of year Mercedes party, and I sat next to Paul Morgan at dinner, and Paul said, what are you going to do?
To give people some context, that's Paul Morgan from Ilmor Engines, and they were making the Mercedes Formula One engines and the Champ Car engines, isn't it?
Yeah, they're making the IndyCar, the F1, and Mario Ilion, with his partner Ilmor, was the genius on the engine design, and Paul was very much the man that made the trains run on time and made everything happen. They were a great partnership and really, really good people. Anyway, I sat next to Paul. He said, what are you going to do? And I said, I'd love to go to America.
Sorry to interrupt, but that is a mindset shift for the Dario Franchitti at that time, because you'd won races in Formula 3. You'd won, as you say, the Young Driver Award, and the ambition was to go to Formula 1.
The ambition had been F1 since I was a little boy. You know, you have got those dreams of being an F1 driver, and as you become older, you realize the difficulties in your path. But I'd wanted to be an F1 driver. But Norbert was a great supporter, but Norbert was also happy with me doing DTM and GT stuff, and I wanted to go to F1. And so there was a bit of a difference of view, shall we say, in that position. Anyway, Paul said, leave it with me. And typical Paul Morgan, I learned that in January the phone rings and it's Paul saying, right, I've organized a test for you with Carl Hogan, and if it goes well, you're in for the season. Norbert's going to have to stump up some cash for some engines and stuff, but yeah, there you go. I just thought, what? Okay, thanks, Paul.
And you felt all your Christmases had come at once at that point?
I did. At that point, Jan Magnussen had gone over and raced at the end of 96 in IndyCar, and he loved it. And he said, if you get the chance to do this, you've got to do it. And so that was part of my thinking to go over and try this. So I went and did the test. The test went well, and the deal happened with Carl. And then I get the phone call saying, can you come to Woking? I don't remember if it was from Ron's office or from Norbert's office, but can you come to Woking? Norbert and Ron want to see you. I phoned Julian Jacoby, my manager, and I said, Julian, this is happening. He said, oh, good. Well, we should go. So then I said to the guy, can my manager come? And they said, absolutely not.
That's so funny, because Ron would have known Julian very, very well from the Prost and Senna days.
I got the impression there was a bit of, I think, Ron and Norbert, there'd been some dealings because Julian worked with Alan and Ayrton Senna this back in the late 80s. He still worked with Alan at that point. So there might have been a couple of deals that they'd done, and those guys were maybe smarting from the deals. Anyway, upshot was I ended up going to Woking and sitting across the desk from Norbert and Ron.
And what was the proposal?
So the proposal was that I would become test driver, and they would also help fund my IndyCar stuff. West had just done the deal, I think, to sponsor, I think 97, it was already West, wasn't it? They were going to sponsor the IndyCar through one of their brands, I think. So a week would look something like, and I remember them telling me this, a week would look like I would race on the Sunday in, say, mid-Ohio. They'd fly me from Mansfield Airport in a little plane up to JFK. I'd jump on the Concorde, fly back to Heathrow. They'd put me on another little plane. I'd go to Jerez, for instance. I'd test Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at Jerez. And then I would reverse the journey and go to the next IndyCar race. So it was going to be punchy.
That's brutal.
That would have been brutal. I mean, it was, in the one hand, it was an amazing opportunity. Also, when you read the contract, it was something like, the term was, I can't remember how long, it was the number 9 years sticks in my head, but they, on their side, could get rid of me at any point. And I just didn't feel confident in that. It just didn't sit right. And when I look back now, I wonder how life would have been different at that point had I done that deal. But I also could have been one of these guys who just sits and is a test driver forever, and there wouldn't be, you know, three BorgWarner trophies sitting over there.
But I thought they said you could continue racing in IndyCar.
Yeah, but that was not sustainable, was it? I mean, that
schedule's not sustainable.
That's just not sustainable in any way, shape, or form. That was the
sliding doors moment, maybe.
That might have been the sliding doors moment. And some odd stuff happened around then. You know, I went straight downstairs from that meeting and made a seat for the 97 car.
Hang on, what? So at this point, you haven't said no.
I haven't said anything, no. I haven't said a word. I said, I need to go and talk to Julian about this.
So before leaving the building, you do a seat fit?
Went downstairs, did a seat fit for the 97 car, and David Brown was there. David had left Williams and come to McLaren. And I think he'd basically told Ron at one point the car was a bag of crap, and Ron didn't appreciate that. So David then comes to an IndyCar, or a couple of IndyCar tests as my kind of chaperone. At that point, one of the great race engineers, and he's sort of chaperoning me, and Carl Hogan took exception to the fact that Ron had sent someone to be his chaperone, and it got a bit messy, shall we say. Could have been a big chance, but I didn't.
I mean, look, the success, as you say, in IndyCar, the four IndyCar championships, the 500s that followed, but can we just investigate the F1 thing a bit more? Because when you say no to Ron Dennis, what did you think that was going to do for your long-term future with regards to Formula One?
I wasn't sure with regards to F1. Honestly, I knew it was probably not going to be a good thing for my long-term future with Mercedes, and certainly not with McLaren. You know, Ron and I didn't speak for about 25 years.
Because of that?
Yeah, I guess. I saw him at Goodwood. It turned out it was the day that he got paid out all the money when he left. It was actually the day the check arrived. And I sat next to his girlfriend, and my wife Ellie sat next to him at dinner at Goodwood, and he was on flying form. And it was actually nice to chat to him, because, you know, what he's achieved and what he's done is quite remarkable.
This episode is sponsored by Vanta. When you're running a business, proving your security practices isn't just a nice to have, it's a non-negotiable. Whether you're a startup founder tackling your first compliance audit, or a security pro looking to streamline risk management, Vanta makes the whole process faster and easier. Vanta is a trust management platform
that helps businesses automate security and compliance, helping you get audit ready in weeks instead of months. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for over 35 security and privacy frameworks, including SOC 2, ISO 27001, and the latest European frameworks like the EU AI Act and DORA. That means up to 90% of the work is handled for you, saving you time and up to 85% of costs. Vanta doesn't just get you compliant, it helps you stay compliant, continuously monitoring risks and streamlining security reviews. Plus, with AI-driven tools, you can complete security questionnaires up to 5 times faster. And it's not just about efficiency, it's about results. A recent IDC white paper found that Vanta customers see $535,000 per year in benefits, and the platform pays for itself in just 3 months. For a limited time, listeners to this show get $1,000 off Vanta at vanta.com/grid. That's vanta.com/grid for $1,000 off.
I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service, it's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
So the fast forward 3 years. By now, you are winning races in IndyCar. In fact, 1999, you finish equal on points with Juan Pablo Montoya in the championship battle. And the opportunity arises for you to test with Jaguar in July 2000. I think it's fair to say it didn't go as well as the McLaren test.
Yeah, so the 98-99 seasons were pretty good, getting into championship contention. The end of 99, ending the championship on equal points, but Monty won due to a countback, as he should have. I think he won 7 races, I won 3 or something. But unfortunately, at that race, Greg was killed.
That's Greg Moore, who we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
He was a great chum, wasn't he?
Yeah, Greg was a great pal, hence the fact there's a large oil painting of him sitting next to my desk. When that happened, I was pretty devastated, and I basically walked away and said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I might stop. And I went away for the winter, and I didn't go near a car until spring training, which would have been late February, maybe early March. Part of the car failed. It was on an oval at Homestead. Part of the car failed and hit the wall. But the way it hit the wall, my head, the helmet hit the wall. And so that broke my pelvis, various other injuries. But the brain damage was pretty severe. That was the sort of the lead up to the start of 2000.
But Dario, we knew less about concussion back then. I mean, how serious did you think your injuries were at the time?
I was more concerned about the broken pelvis, quite frankly. I was back in the car, I think, 3 weeks later. I did a race, which when they dropped the car off the jacks in the first pit stop wasn't the most pleasant experience of my life. But it literally took me years to get over some of those injuries. And some of them I've never recovered from, some of the brain damage that was done in that crash. It was a monster.
How does it affect you today?
Memory, certain parts of memory, names, faces, just a part of the brain.
And yet you were in a racing car 3 weeks
later. Yeah.
How did it affect you in the car?
I was okay for tearing off a lap. And this will come into the Jaguar test. I was okay for just doing a qualifying lap. I think during that year, I broke the lap record at Road America, which still stands to this day. So I was okay with that because, again, I knew I was repeating. I wasn't learning something new. But in a race, oh my God, I couldn't focus for more than sort of 4 or 5 laps at a time. Yeah, it was a bit of a disaster. So that was the lead up to the Jaguar test. So what happened there was, I think Julian had been talking to Jackie. Now, Julian and Jackie had talked, and Jackie being Jackie Stewart, had talked back in the Stewart Grand Prix days about Julian and I had gone to the Montreal race in 97, and Greg was there too. And Jackie was talking to Greg, and then Greg would go away. I'd come in and Jackie would talk to me about getting in the car at some point, but it never happened. But Julian said to Jackie, "Ah, oh, you should test Ario." Obviously, it's now Jaguar. It's no longer Stewart. But Jackie had a big say in what went on with Ford. So the next thing I know, I'm in Dearborn in that building signing a contract. Nothing was simple because I had done a deal with Barry Green for the future. But Barry, being Barry, just a really cool guy, said, "Listen, I'll do a deal with you. If you get the F1 opportunity, that's fine. But if not, you've got to sign with me for another X years." That's what we did anyway. So I'm in Dearborn signing this long-term Jaguar contract. If the test goes well, you know, I'll drive for Jaguar in F1 for a number of years.
Dario, that is hugely exciting, right?
That was exciting, yeah. Particularly, you think of the mindset. I'd had that huge accident on the ovals. And from that point on, I was pretty scared of ovals for quite a few years.
And then you go and win the Indy 500 times.
That was 7 years later, though. You know, it helps to have, you know, a short memory and no imagination.
But at the time, were you thinking, I'd quite like to get off the ovals?
Yes.
F1 was appealing from that aspect as well.
And at that point, I still had a real hankering to do F1. I've just said something there that I almost need to backtrack on. It wasn't to do F1. This was my biggest problem. I wanted to win an F1. And by that point, I was driving race-winning equipment in IndyCar. And I was maybe not as prepared to be as patient or risk getting in some car that was not a front-running car straight away, which is not realistic. I understand that.
But hang on, Dad, I do understand that, because at the time, Formula One had a bit of a love affair with IndyCar drivers. Jacques Villeneuve had come straight over at the end of 95 and got into a race-winning Williams. Juan Pablo Montoya was in the throes of doing a deal to come into Formula One in 2001. In fact, he'd already done it by the time he drove the Jaguar. You know, and Alex Zanardi, of course, had been at the Williams, an unsuccessful stint at Williams the previous year. So it was a well-trodden path at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. Things had changed from the Jacques era. I mean, Jacques did a phenomenal job. It was just showing up. The car was good and everything, but my God, he did so well. It was really cool to see that. But the groove tires came in for 1998, and I think that's why Alex Zanardi struggled as much, because we were used to these sort of heavier cars, physically bigger car with a load of mechanical grip, and maybe not the aero loads that you saw in an F1 car, not as nimble, but this basically load of mechanical grip. And it was very, very difficult, which I subsequently found out, to drive the groove tires. I did the deal in Dearborn. The best bit about the test was, because of the tight schedule in IndyCar, I had to go and do a seat fit in Milton Keynes. They stuck me on Concorde to go and do a seat fit. I thought, this is all right. So Concorde over, seat fit, Concorde back.
You came over to Milton Keynes just for the seat fit?
Just for the seat.
And then went back to the US?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right in the middle of the IndyCar season. And even at the seat fit, there's some of the guys I knew very well from the Paul Stewart Racing days. And I was a bit shocked at the lack of team morale, the lack of leadership, maybe. Everybody had an opinion on why they sucked, but the people at the top weren't doing anything about it. It was shocking, actually. I was used to being in these teams that were like a razor-sharp organizations, and this wasn't, even from the seat fit. So I went back to the test. And at that time, I mean, I don't know how many cars were at the test. It was everybody tested together.
Yeah, so it was July, wasn't it? And I think, you know, certainly Coulthard was there in the McLaren. I know BAR were doing a lot of running that day. I think the Benetton was there. I mean, there were a few cars, weren't there?
There was probably 15 cars, I seem to remember. And we had a press conference, and my lawyer at the time, Peter Goodman, who'd been with me since the David Leslie days, was sitting off stage left. And if I got asked a question, I had to turn to Peter and be like, and he would nod or shake his head if I could answer the bloody question. It was utter madness.
What are your memories of the car, the Jaguar R1? You've talked about the groove tyres and the lack of mechanical grip. What was it like going through cops and Beckett's and all the high speed stuff.
I always remember thinking, how could a car that feels so quick be so slow? Into cops, the change of direction. The one thing I remember is that change of direction. And then through the first part of Beckett's, it was, yeah, wow. That was good. But then on the straight, the IndyCar would keep accelerating, even in road track trim, even, you know, with the big wings on it, it would just keep accelerating. This thing just hit a brick wall. That was something that was a bit different for me. The braking, again, the lack of mass, which is something I think F1 cars are missing now, is they're so big now, but that lack of mass, just an instant response to the brakes, that was exciting. I struggled physically, and it goes back to that accident at Homestead. I had some issues with my neck from the accident and some bulging discs, and I couldn't exercise my neck. Not I couldn't exercise my neck to this F1 standards. I couldn't exercise it at all. So I was really struggling physically.
Quite quickly.
Very quickly. Not only couldn't I hold my head up, but one of the side effects was my right hand would go numb because of the bulging disc.
You said something earlier, Dario, that post-accident, you were able to turn a lap in a car that you knew well. You weren't learning anything new. Of course, a Formula One car was a new experience. Silverstone is a pretty unforgiving place in a bad car.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was the perfect storm, really.
It was, you know, and at the time I said, you know, the team, it was very clear that I wasn't wanted in the team. And some of the guys who I've known from the Paul Stewart racing days said, oh, I can't believe you said that. That was, and is still true. I was not their choice. I was Ford's choice through Jackie. And that probably didn't sit well with them.
What about later in the year when there was a change at the top? Bobby Rahal is brought in as team principal. Of course, Bobby knew you well from America. Would that have changed anything for you?
Well, I think the, going back to the test for a minute, I think the struggle of me trying to figure out something new and not mentally being able to do it because of the damage I'd done was part of it. The fact that they just really weren't that interested from a team perspective as well. The, you know, coming back for the second day and I'm like, here's my car. And they're like, oh no, you're in that car today. I was like, oh God, okay. It was pretty clear what was going on. And so between that and me just not doing a good job, I mean, I didn't maximize what I had because of all the excuses I've essentially, you know, I've given you. But
Dario, I'm reminded so much of, crikey, I'm showing my age now, but I remember being at Silverstone at the end of 95 when Villeneuve came over and started testing for Williams, and the support, the network of people around him, and it was so clear in the body language of everyone in the team. It just, I'm only highlighting, I think, probably what you're saying, which is how difficult it must be to walk into a team that isn't really buying into what's going on.
Yeah, that's probably a good, a better way of putting it. And I just didn't want anything to do with that level of hassle. And, you know, I literally after 2 days, I was like, I don't want to be involved in this. And Neil Ressler, who was sort of in charge at the time, Neil and I actually became pals afterwards. And he called me and he said, hey, it didn't go as we'd hoped and all that. And I said, yeah. I remember I was driving through New York, through the middle of New York when the call came in. And I said, yeah, I really don't think it's going to work for either of us. I said, I don't think I did a good job.
Did you explain to the management at the time about the after effects, the knock-on effects of
God,
the crash?
No. I was keeping that well hidden.
But why?
Because I didn't want anybody in the IndyCar team to know about it. I mean, I was in all kinds of bother. You're just trying to keep my head above water there. Yeah, I wasn't telling anybody.
Well, Dario, you said there were three moments when F1 could have happened. We've discussed two of them. And then you said there was an opportunity at BAR. Tell us about that.
Yeah, actually, I forgot the Prost stuff.
Oh my God, there was four.
There was probably more. Because Alan and I had done some DTM testing together. He was involved in the McLaren thing. And then he started running his own team. And obviously, Julian and him go back forever. He was a supporter. He was always very positive about what I did, and there was a chance at one point to maybe jump in the car. But
can you remember what era?
No, it didn't get too far down the road because it became, I guess, the all kinds of politics on that. But the BAR thing, it would have been 2001 or maybe late 2000. I can't remember. I was at Fontana testing, And Craig Pollock had phoned and said, hey, you know, I want you to come and be Jacques' teammate. And I'd been involved with Craig when him and Julian had looked after Jacques when Jacques first came to F1. So, and Craig went to my first IndyCar test with me. So I knew him pretty well. And he said, you know, I want you to do this. We're going to sort everything out, because I had a long-term contract with Team Green.
But Team Green was sponsored by British American Tobacco. So there was a nice link between BAR and not an insurmountable problem having a long-term contract with Team Green, I guess.
No, it wasn't. But Barry Green wasn't best happy, shall we say. I think Barry at that time, they were considering moving him in to run the F1 team because it wasn't going quite so well. Anyway, there was a bit of politics going on there. But at that point, it didn't seem the right thing to go into the team. I think anybody that had been teammates with Jacques at BAR, it hadn't worked out well for them. And I just, again, I was, by that point, was a bit happier.
You didn't think about it seriously?
No, I really didn't. Not more than 10 minutes. And that was really the last chance. And there might have been some lack of confidence on my part of putting myself out there. Again, it comes back to that risk. I wasn't prepared to go all in for my F1 dream. I wasn't prepared to risk what I had in America.
But even if it hadn't worked out in F1, you were such a force in the US at this point. You could have just walked straight back in. Can I just say that, you know, later on, you go and do one season in NASCAR, which didn't work out. You come back the next year and win the championship. So I feel very strongly that if it hadn't worked out in F1, you could have come back.
I don't know.
And I think you could fancy your chances against Villeneuve, actually, in an F1 car.
Yeah, I think I was a bit maybe gun-shy after the Jaguar experience. But again, it didn't work for Zanardi. Didn't work for Zanardi. Zanardi came back to IndyCar and really struggled. He was getting it figured out again. I mean, when he had his accident, he was leading the race, but he'd struggled to come back. And trust me, when he left at the end of 98, he was bloody hard to beat. Yeah, he was the standard setter.
This episode is sponsored by Shopify. If you've shopped online, chances are you've bought from a business powered by Shopify. You know that purple Shop Pay button at checkout? The one that makes buying so incredibly easy? That's Shopify. And there's a reason so many businesses use it. Because Shopify makes it incredibly easy to start and run your business. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. From major names like Mattel and Gymshark to small brands just getting started. It's the go-to platform for millions of businesses worldwide. What's great about Shopify is that it gives you a leg up from day one. You can build your storefront using hundreds of beautiful ready-to-go templates, no coding required. Plus, you can manage everything in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics. And when it comes to marketing, Shopify has you covered there too, with its inbuilt marketing and email tools designed to help you spread the word about your brand. Oh, and that iconic purple Shop Pay button, it's not just popular. It's the best converting checkout on the planet. Your customers already love it. If you want to see fewer carts being abandoned, it's time for you to head over to Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/beyondthegrid. shopify.com/beyondthegrid.
I've always been the type to go all in. When I get into something, whether it's fitness, food, or just following every twist and turn of the season, I want to explore every angle. That's why Prime is such a game changer. It's not just fast delivery, though getting a new cookbook or resistance bands the next day definitely helps. It's also the deep dives on Prime Video, the playlists that match my mood on Amazon Music, and the way all of it comes together to keep me going. What I've learnt is this: Prime isn't just a service. It's a hub, a place where my interests, old and new, can live and grow. From race day rituals to everyday obsessions, Prime helps me get more out of whatever I'm into, and even shows me what's next. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. From streaming to shopping, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into. amazon.com/prime.
There's more from Dario in a moment. And once our chat's finished, why not check out F1's other official podcasts? F1 Nation's review of the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix is out now. We're joined by former Red Bull driver Daniil Kvyat to reflect on Max Verstappen's stunning win at Imola. And the latest episode of F1 Explains comes from inside the Haas garage. And it's all about what the pit crew, mechanics and engineers do during a race. You can find those shows on your podcast app. Let's talk about some of those successes in IndyCar. And I did want to ask, how complete do you need to be on a street course 1 week, an oval the week after that, a permanent road course the week after that?
I think experience helps in that situation. You know, as a rookie, it's very difficult to adjust to that. Certainly my rookie year, I'd jump on the street courses and I got right up to speed. The road courses, yeah, it felt normal. And then you come to a short oval and you, oh my God, you were sort of learning this new way of racing. And then you get on a super speedway the week after that and you're doing 240 miles an hour going, oh, what am I doing? To be strong on all those, when you get right to the top of your game, is very difficult. And my weakness is I learned to strengthen them through watching teammates. That was, I think, a way that I really was able to lift my game.
If you had a favorite discipline by the end, what would it be?
I loved street courses. Man, I loved the challenge. I loved smashing over the bumps in Toronto, you know, three or four surfaces in one corner, all different grip levels, making the car float over the bumps between the walls, inch perfect, on a qualifying lap. That was something special. By the end, I adored Indianapolis. Didn't like it the first year. Place terrified me and I just wasn't very good at it.
I mean, how difficult is it to tame Indianapolis? And in you describing that, can you also just bring in the challenge that Fernando Alonso set himself when he went there? No previous experience on ovals, the scale of the challenge for him?
Such a hard thing that Fernando did, and he did a really good job, and not surprising. I say world class, he's got that 0.01%, doesn't he? He's something special. Watching what he was doing, and I remember talking to the guys at McLaren, his feel for the car was special. And you got to have that. At Indy, the car is floating at, you know, average speeds of 235 miles an hour in qualifying. You're absolutely floating the car. You're backing it into the corner, depending on the wind direction. It's the tightest of tight ropes because the speed deltas between slowest and fastest speed on a lap is so small. The margin for error is minuscule. The car is only designed to turn left. It's only set up to turn left. Because of that, you're sort of so close to the perfect lap, the perfect balance, that the slightest gust of wind or temperature change knocks it out of that balance. And at those speeds with the wall right next to you, it focuses the mind, shall we say.
You know, you talk about the finesse. Are you feeling it through your hands or through your bum more at Indy?
Both. You really are. You're feeling everything. Every sense you've got is heightened to a level you didn't think was possible. To be fast, to be really, really, really good around Indy, every sense is on high alert. And in the race, it's on high alert for 3 hours.
And what is the difference between a quali lap and one of the 200 laps in the race? Are you 10% back in the race?
Oh no, you're flat out in the race. In qualifying, you've generally got a lot less downforce in the car. So I've been in the position of thinking the car is sliding so much, I'm actually slowing myself down because it's sliding. You go oversteer in through the middle of a corner or whatever, and the engineer says, look, we've got to trim it out. And you're thinking, there's no bloody way. And hence the battle commences with the battle of wills with the engineer. But in the race, you're managing traffic as much as anything. You're managing the dirty air from the cars in front of you. You're setting up the balance of the car. In order to overtake cars at Indy, mechanically, the car's got to turn itself to negate the front wing losing its effectiveness in traffic. So you're essentially in a controlled slide through the corner.
So you're turning it with the throttle, not your hands?
Well, you're full throttle if you got it right.
The way around?
Well, you're lifting on the straights and flat through the corners. That's the way to pass people at Indianapolis. You've got to lift on the straight, manage your gap, and then accelerate through turn one to get onto the gearbox halfway through turn two to then pass up to turn three.
So strategic.
But you're managing that constantly moving landscape with the traffic. That's one of the keys to it. It depends on wind direction too, temperature, and you're managing the tools in the car and adjusting your roll bars, your weight jacker, all these different things nonstop. I love it.
Derek, given your road racing background, you know, we talked about Paul Stewart racing, you were, you know, on the Jackie Stewart staircase of talent. Did you surprise yourself on the ovals how well you adapted? And
not at first, because I was crap. No, I struggled at first. I really did. I struggled with the feeling of the car, what I needed. I just didn't know the mental toughness required. Get it wrong, it hurts on an oval. And so you've got to get straight back in. And that's a different mindset. And I wish I had the speed that I had in 98, 99, for instance, the mindset I had from the 2007, 9, 10, 11, 12.
You think you lost speed?
Oh, yeah.
Because of Homestead? The crash at Homestead?
No, because of age. I didn't lose speed on the ovals. I got better on the ovals as the years went on. But on the road courses, I lost speed just through natural aging, I think.
Fernando Alonso was very interesting about age. When asked how he's still able to do what he does, he was sort of saying, I've lived like a monk since I was 20 years old, and I'm seeing the benefits of that now, in that if I'd lived like, you know, the university years, I wouldn't be as sharp now as I was.
I can see that. And I definitely was more disciplined in my later, again, those successful years, because I could see time running out. It's an interesting arc, my sort of career, because of the success in 99, you know, looking right, you know, right on the top of my game. And then the accident happened, and trying to recover out of that hole from that accident took a long time. And so there was a part of that and learning to cope with the problems that created. And I think that made me stronger when I got the opportunity again. And when I was ready again, physically and mentally, to do that, that 07, 10, 11, 12 period of success. You learn different ways to win races as you get older. I was probably too mentally soft in hindsight in those early years. In a lot of ways, I was single-minded to get from where I started to where I got to. I had to be quite mentally strong, but I could have been better. Again, I saw what I could do in those later years, and I wished I had that mental single-mindedness.
Isn't that maturity, though?
It might be maturity, yeah. But I wish I'd had it earlier. It would have been cracking.
Dario, what about the four titles versus the three Indy 500 wins? What do you treasure more?
Well, behind my desk there's three trophies. The championship trophies are up in Scotland. Got to bring them down, actually.
But the 500. Fact is, it's the 500 that's here in the office. Is that, they were the highest of highs?
Yeah, they were. They absolutely were. The championship, though, because it's a fight for a whole season. Everybody talks about the last races. This happened in the last races. You pay the same points in the first race as you do in the last, right? But it's that battle. You, your whole team going into that. And in some ways, your family are going to that battle with you because they're having to live with you. You know, a lot of times I see my ex-wife, I apologize to her because I'm just such a, you know, single-minded individual, shall we say. But the 500s are just because of what it means. It is such a special race. Anybody that's been there would maybe understand that.
The IndyCar drivers of today, would the top ones succeed in Formula One?
Yeah.
The Alex Palaus, the Pato Awards.
Palau and Award, they tested at the same time, actually, in the McLaren. My understanding was that they were pace-wise over a lap about quite the same, but their team's understanding was Palau was using much less of himself, shall we say, and had a lot of headroom, where Pato was maybe closer to the limit. Pato's pretty spectacular. Good fun to watch.
He's fun to watch. What do they call him? Quick hands, don't they?
Yeah. You put any of the IndyCar guys, and this goes back to the Jacques Villeneuve days, you know, after that, Dixon, myself, Dan Weldon, I'm just thinking of all the different drivers. They put us in the right situation. Yeah, we could have all done a really good job.
One other guy I did want to talk to you about was your cousin, Paul De Resta. Your success in IndyCar allowed you to help him get started in racing. How good was Paul? I mean, he had a few fourth places. You're actually laughing.
I'm laughing. There's a funny story. I'll tell you why I'm laughing. I was in Miami airport on Tuesday night, and I went for a pee, and I'm standing at the urinal, and a guy next to me says, "Nice hair," and it's Paul.
It's Paul De Resta.
It's Paul, and him and Laura and the kids had been in Disney and everything, and they were heading home. How small is the world?
Yeah, that's crazy.
I mean, God. Just as a pure talent, phenomenal. You know, we beat Seb Vettel in F3. Again, he was in the DTM system.
He had a very similar path to you, actually, in the juniors, didn't he?
He did, but, you know, we talked earlier about me not being prepared to go all in. I wasn't prepared to risk everything for this F1 dream. Paul was just like, yeah, bang, I'm doing it. He had the talent to excel. I would suggest he looks back on it and thinks there's things he could have done better out of the car. You know, and at the time I was sort of trying to help him navigate that. And that was a shame. It was a shame he didn't get to fulfill his potential.
Dario, there's one other F1 link I wanted to ask you about. And it involves what you're doing now. One of the greatest F1 designers of all time, Gordon Murray. You are working with him. Tell us what you're up to.
What part of my life since my last big accident in 2013, I've worked with Chip Ganassi as an advisor to the team. I've done that the whole time. And then in 2020, Gordon was looking at launching the T50 supercar. He asked me to come on board, sort of not temporary, but part-time, and as an ambassador. And that's kind of basically we had dinner one night and he got me drunk on red wine and he proposed that I come on full time, which I said I couldn't do, but I'd sort of do 3 days a week at Gordon Murray Automotive I'm now director of brand and product. So I've got an office. Not this office either. I've got another one.
That's a very impressive sounding job. I mean, it's the T50 is, I probably should give some background in that it was Gordon Murray's pen. Well, all of the great Brabham Formula One cars from 1973 up until really the end of the Bernie Ecclestone era were his. He was the guy that introduced refueling. There was the Brabham fan car in the 70s. But he also then went to McLaren, and it was his pen that designed the McLaren F1 road car. And then now there's the T50, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you driven both? Yeah, the McLaren F1 and the T50?
Yeah, I drove them on the same day. Gordon and I went to Spain last year. They were doing an article on both cars. Henry Catchpole was doing it, and he was going to do the comparison. So we basically flew down, nicked the cars, and spent the day driving around the mountains of Spain. The biggest difference is 30 years. You think about it, 30 years difference in tire technology, brake technology, and it really shows. The game's moved on. The F1, when it came out, it set the standard in speed and in all kinds of areas. But then cars have continued to get bigger, heavier, and quicker, but losing driver involvement, where T50 takes it the other way. And Gordon's just said, number one, this car has to be about driver involvement. Driving perfection, he calls it. It needs to be driving perfection. It's about the experience of driving the car. And both F1 and T50 do that. T50 is a bit sharper. It's got modern tires. It's got modern brakes. It's got ABS, which doesn't interfere in the driving experience. Probably the biggest difference is the BMW engine is a thing of wonder, but it's a big old engine. And you feel the center of gravity move when you go into a corner. You feel the engine making an appearance. The T50, the engine is tiny. I mean, it's something, it looks like a late 80s V12 F1 engine. And it's got so many advantages because of that. T50 is a little bit lighter. That helps. I mean, the F1 was very light. T50 is very light. But it's got that three-seat center driving position cockpit too. And it is a cracking thing. I've got one coming.
Oh, it's going to be next to the F40 then.
It's going to be, yeah, it's probably, I'll probably stick it in next to the F40, but it'll be here end of the year.
And what's it like working with Gordon Murray? I mean, does it A, take you back to your racing days? And can you imagine him and Nelson Piquet and Niki Lauda? And is he a very good problem solver?
Oh, he's an incredible problem solver. The best bit about my job is driving the cars is fantastic, which is a small part of it actually. But the best bit is when I go to his house and we spend a morning that sometimes ends up being, it's supposed to be just a morning, ends up being an afternoon too. And we start talking about the future products, where we're going to go with those, the current products, how we're tweaking them. And then we start talking about road cars. It can be modern F1, it can be the BT44, it can be working with Niki, it can be working with Nelson, working with Senna, you name it. We go down these roads and I just think at times, how the hell did I get here? How lucky am I? 3 or 4 years ago, I drove the Duckhams that he designed for Alan de Cadney. I drove the car at Laguna, I raced it. And after the race, Gordon, Marino and I sat in the truck and debriefed. And as we got, Marino and I got in the rental car, and we were driving out of the circuit, and he turned to me and he said, as kids, what would we have given to sit and debrief with Gordon Murray about a race you've just done in one of his cars? And that to me sums it up. There's a big degree of hero worship from my side. He's something special.
You know how the McLaren F1 went to Le Mans and it won the race in 1995? Does Gordon have any ambition to go back to Le Mans with one of his cars?
Yeah, I think he would love to. He really would. We were talking about the anniversary, the 30-year anniversary this year of that happening. He's a racer at heart. He loves racing. And so, you know, who knows? We've got the T50S track car. It sounds like a late 80s F1 car. I absolutely adore it. That couldn't, because it's got the fan, movable aerodynamic device, that kind of stuff. It would be a difficult thing to get there. But the long-term plan for Gordon Murray Automotive is to go racing at some point. And he loves Le Mans. He loves Le Mans. He loves long-tail cars.
Talking of Le Mans, I find it nuts that you have never raced there. But I believe there might have been an opportunity had you not had that career-ending crash in Houston in 2013.
By 2013, I was getting to the point I could feel the motivation for what I was doing just starting to taper off. And it was really important to me that I wasn't the weak link in the chain at Ganassi. I'd been given such a terrific opportunity in 2009. We'd gone on a bit of a tear winning, you know, the three championships in a row and the two 500s. And, you know, for me, going up against Scott, literally as I walked in the door of the team, I thought, I just don't want to embarrass myself. That was my mindset. You know, some guys go in there going, I'm going to destroy my teammate. I was like, I don't want to embarrass myself. So it worked out. It worked out okay.
Of course it did. You beat him.
But I'd always been fascinated by Le Mans. I love it. I got discussing it with Wolfgang Hatz, who was running the development at Porsche at the time and was, you know, on the board there. And he was keen that I'd come and have a chat about it. And my old buddy Mark Webber and I were working it from the back as well. Mark was working it because we wanted to race together. You know, I'd known Mark since, God, the mid-90s. We wanted to do this. 2013, January, I went to Weissach. And the plan was that I would probably do 13 and 14 in IndyCar. That would be the end of my Ganassi contract. And I would go and drive the 919 Porsche. And that would involve Le Mans and being involved with Mr. Webber, racing with him. And unfortunately, because of the crash, it didn't happen. So I guess two things I regret. I got to do a lot of cool stuff. The IndyCar stuff, the wins, all that. That was beyond my wildest expectations, actually, what I was actually able to achieve. But I missed not racing at Le Mans. And this only occurred to me about 2 years ago. I missed competing in my home Grand Prix. You know, I always said to you, I wanted to win in F1. I wanted to be in F1, not to just be in F1. I wanted to be within a chance of winning and put myself in a position where I could compete. But that's one of the regrets. I'll tell you where it occurred to me. I was judging the Young Driver of the Year a couple of Novembers ago, and Johnny Herbert came on as a guest judge, and him and I were both limping up the stairs to go across the bridge to the hotel, and there was a picture of him in the Benetton suit having just won. And then I thought, yeah, that would have been cool.
That would have been so cool. You would have made a lot of people very proud, including Jackie Stewart, who was a mentor for you, wasn't he?
And then some, yeah. And still is to this day, Jackie is. I said that to my oldest daughter, Sophia. I can't remember what we're doing, but I introduced her to Jackie. And she hears Ellie and I talk about Jackie. She was asking about him. Darling, without Jackie, we'd be living in a smaller house, was how I put it. And she wanted to understand about Jackie, so she did her own research. And she went to World Book Day at school, dressed as Sir Jackie Stewart, with a tartan bonnet and everything. And she gave all her savings to race against dementia. But that shows, I think, the way Jackie has affected our family. From the first day I sat with him, the Paul Stewart Racing Christmas party in 1991 until today, he's had a massive effect. And probably my dad and Jackie, they're probably the two had the most effect on my direction of travel in life.
What is the best piece of advice that Jackie Stewart ever gave you?
There's so many pieces of advice. My biggest thing with Jackie, though, is I watched him and I learned by watching him. He led by example, and I watched how he did things, how he conducted himself, how he handled himself. As I say, I literally think about something he taught me every day. When I went to Paul Stewart Racing, I could not stand up in front of five people and speak. And he sent Jan and myself to public speaking courses, little things like that. And just, he was always trying to improve these young drivers that were in his charge, whether that was on the track or off. We used to do the days where we go to Oldham Park and he'd...
With a tennis ball on the bonnet?
No, there was no tennis ball on the bonnet at those points, but we would we'd get there and he would take us round and show us how it was done. And it was just silky smooth. And then we would get in and have a bit of a hack at it. And eventually we thought, right, enough's enough. Let's see who's quicker. We didn't tell him this, but we stopwatch in pocket. And he was quicker. Silky smooth. And this was, God, he would have been in his 50s. We were, I mean, I was 18. Jan and I would have been the same age. And we thought we were all that. And we weren't. He was still that good. Actually, in that cupboard over there, I've got Jackie's last windsuit from Nürburgring, 73.
And when you were discussing with your daughter, Sophia, it is true to say that without Jackie, you wouldn't have had a racing career, or is that too extreme?
Without him, I'm really not sure I would have. And I don't think I would have, because go back to 1991, my mum and dad, well, my dad remortgaged our house, our family home, without telling my mum, to pay David Leslie the budget for that first year. I mean, and Father David and David Leslie were just incredible too, and they're part of the story. But then I went to, Jackie had seen me race, and I went to this Christmas party, and we had a bit of a chat, and I was there in my, you know, 100 quid CNA suit, and I've told this story before, but they had the Christmas quiz, and there was one question about Stirling Moss, and so Jackie pulls out his flip phone and calls Stirling for the answer to the question. And I just thought, oh, you're in the big time now, son. But Jackie, shortly thereafter, said to me, I was home in Scotland, and he phoned me and he said, right, I think we can do this. He said, I'll find the money and you do your best in the car. And, you know, he was able to corral this who's who of Scottish companies to help support myself and you know, Paul Stewart Racing. And without that, you know, there wasn't just, it wasn't going to happen. And then, of course, the Mercedes thing happened from that.
And then there was no stopping you.
And then there was no stopping. Well, there, a couple of walls stopped me occasionally, but yeah.
Oh, Dario, it has been wonderful to chat. Thank you very, very much for your time. Really enjoyed it. There's one final question I have for you. It's something I'm asking everybody on the show this year. It is the 75th anniversary of Formula One. Do you have a favourite race or a favourite moment from Formula One history?
There's all kinds of things bouncing around my head here, but I have to say the 1978 season, you know, Mario in the 79, Nicky in the fan car. And the reason for that is that's what started my love of motor racing, that season. You know, those cars, if you look behind you, there's all these models of late 70s F1 cars, those big Goodyear tires behind. That ignited the passion I have for the sport. My dad and I sitting watching it and watching the races on TV. And yeah.
Dario, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Tom.
What a wonderful conversation with Dario. His passion for racing is infectious, isn't it? He must have been such a joy to go racing with. There's no doubt that IndyCar's gain was F1's loss, and we can only speculate as to what might have been had one of those F1 chances materialised. I'm especially interested in BAR, because by 2004, the team was in great shape. It finished second in the Constructors' Championship, and Jenson Button scored 10 podiums. Just think about that. Ifs, whats, and maybes. One thing's for sure, Dario had a wonderful career in America, and he can treasure those IndyCar championships and 3 Indy 500 wins. He's at the Brickyard this week, and no doubt having a blast. Dario, thank you for coming on the show, and I hope to see you again soon. Well, that's almost it for this episode. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One. F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audio Boom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.